Up next, we have IPM agent Kerry Siders with a pest update.
But how many of you old-timers remember when we, 27 years ago, that would be 1993, when we actually hijacked Crosby County's cotton conference from the old museum that Rick Smathers had kind of started, and we moved it, made it a Floyd Crosby County activity, and moved it to the Baptist camp down in Blackcomb Canyon in 1993. I'm guilty of that. We got a couple waving their hands, so remember that. And at that time, it was called the Caprock Cotton Conference. I think they're calling it the Production Conference now to kind of include the grains, which is fair, I guess. We'll let grain, sorghum, and corn come in here too. But I'm going to kind of restrict my initial comments to cotton. I think that's what most of us may be interested in, although I think we look back, 2019 wasn't a very kind year to us, particularly in terms of, it started out to be one of the better, potentially one of the better years. I think we all had good moisture to start with. We were pretty enthusiastic about it, albeit a bit cool, then kind of a rough start, seedling issues, seed quality issues. I don't know all the problems that y'all dealt with up here, but it's probably very similar to what we dealt with on the Western Plains in Hockley, Cochran, and even up in Lamb County. But, really, we did have what we'd consider a good start. But then as we got into the latter part of June and particularly into July, we probably didn't notice it because our daytime high was pretty normal. But what really caught us flat-footed, and this was exhibited if you had a lot of replant cotton, that stuff had plenty of time to make. We had plenty of heat units. Why would that be a problem? Well, if you think back, and I looked at the weather for level land proper, and I know y'all are obviously a little different here, but I think this applies to all the high plains, is our nighttime temperature, which has always been our advantage of cooling down into that anywhere from, 64, 65, generally no warmer than about 67 at night. Sometimes we get up around 68, but usually it's always below 70 degrees. As we got into July, August, and even into September, we were 2 to 5 degrees above normal at nighttime, okay? So we kind of lost that advantage of allowing that plant to metabolize at a slower pace and fully recover at nighttime. And so I think that kind of explains why some of us fail. We looked at a crop that thought, oh, that's easy, 2.5, 3 bales, and you start pulling it and you're getting into barely 2 bales, and that's pretty disappointing from that standpoint. I don't want to beat that dead horse too much because I'm supposed to talk about pests, but I don't think we can blame everything last year on pests, but we always got to be cognizant of pest problems. Actually, last year was somewhat unusual for most all of us in that it was, we had some worm pressure. We had some, some typical cotton pests, but plant bugs last year were bad everywhere. Stink bugs, not so much the ligus. Flea hoppers. We sometimes, we deal with flea hoppers most all the time, but they weren't, they historically, really the past 10, even up to 20 years, haven't been near as bad as what they were last year. So we lost a fair amount of fruit, early fruit, that set us back, but because the length of season and heat units, it did compensate for a lot of that loss. I hope y'all aren't dealing with Pima cotton up here. We are seeing some Pima varieties move into our neck of the woods, which is a big concern because of a new strain of fusarium, which I know y'all deal with fusarium wilt up here. But to illustrate how long a season we all did have is we were able to produce Pima cotton this year, which is highly unusual because we just don't have the heat units for it. But we were capable of doing that in 2019. Okay, see if I can operate this. So, it behooves us to really, some of y'all know we're hiring a private consultant, and that's good. Maybe you're working with field men with different companies to scout your fields. But I think even you individual, excuse me, we just finished our stock show yesterday, so my lungs are full of stock show dust today. But even you producers need to know how to ask the right questions of your consultants or field men and what they're seeing and how to interpret the numbers. You know, I can teach anybody to scout. That's not the issue. The question then becomes, what do you do with all that information? So you guys have got to put all this together. So why do we scout? Okay, it's changing on the computer, but not on the screen. There we go. Okay. So integrated pest management, I know this is a term we've thrown around for many, many years, 35, 40 years. And some people have bad ideas of what IPM is. They think it's anti-chemical or something along those lines. That couldn't be further from the truth. Although we do try to resort to chemicals as last resort, simply because it's not cheap. Y'all know that. We don't just, unlike what maybe some city folks think, we don't just throw chemicals out there for the heck of it. We have to justify it because it's expensive. And so it tends to be at the top of the pyramid. We start off, has this got a laser on it? Yeah, okay. So we try to prevent most of these pest problems, whether, some cultural method, the way we plant, the orientation, the variety, all sorts of things that we can do before we resort to, chemicals that are costly. So that's kind of the picture of what IPM is. And y'all been practicing this for years, even whether you call it IPM or not. This is something that y'all do anyway. Y'all are always trying to, be very frugal with your dollars and make sure that we don't have to spend those dollars later to protect that crop if necessary. And hence, of course, all the technologies that are in the cotton and even in other crops that we try to take advantage of. Okay, just an example of, how we apply, thresholds, for example, when we scout for let's say in this case, stink bugs, where we're finding one stink bug in 12 foot a row. The loss from that one stink bug in every 12 foot a row is only $5. But we know if we spray it ourselves, the cost of that rig to run and the chemical, we're sitting around $10 an acre to spray that particular pest. Now, question. Oh. Somebody's got a question, either throw up your hand or holler, and I'll try to stop and explain a little further. So, if we move to two stink bugs per 12 row feet, now the loss is $10. Now we're at the same level as what it would cost to treat. Okay? So that is the threshold right there. When we get two or more stink bugs per 12 foot a row, it's time to treat. Okay? Now, when it's two stink bugs per row, that covers the cost of application. There's not a huge advantage. But when you get above that, let's say, for example, three stink bugs per 12-foot a row, and now it's cost loss $15 or more, obviously you've not only covered your cost of application, but you're actually, as our wives would say, making money then, right? When you spend money, you make money. All right, so let's talk about those pests from emergence through squaring. And really, the number one pest during that period of time is thrips. It's always spelled with an S at the end. It's never even singular. It's thrips, just a little spelling lesson. Okay, thrips obviously attack that plant from emergence. They can go throughout the season, but typically we try to concentrate on what those thrips are doing prior to the fifth leaf stage. As we get to the fourth leaf stage, then we can make all these calls and determine whether or not they're important. Thrips love wet, cool weather. Now, thrips are very subject to being washed off the plant by good, intense rains, but they really take advantage of that weather in the springtime, and primarily because that cotton plant is not growing off too fast, or not fast enough under those conditions. Now, when it's hot, not necessarily dry, but when it's hot and that plant's making good, fast progress, generally that growth outpaces the damage from the thrips. But when it's in that cool weather, it slows it down. Seed treatments. Phone keeps going off here. Sorry about that. Let me silence this thing. Okay. Seed treatments are really the first, defense against thrips. Now, the other defense would be just knowing what the surroundings are. If you've got CRP or any kind of grassy areas, wheat, where these thrips are harbored during the... that phone's still going off, isn't it? Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah, it's working. But any grassy areas can allow for thrips to overwinter. And then, of course, as those, particularly like wheat, as that wheat dries down, matures, those thrips move then in mass to the cotton. So just be aware of those kind of areas. But really, the seed treatments are first and foremost our defense line. And then we can always follow that up then with some foliar insecticides. Of course, this is the damage, and I don't know with these lights, it's kind of washed out a little bit. But right here next to this terminal, these are the seed leaf petioles. But you can see those straw-colored, very small thrips there near that terminal fixing to attack that young growth right there in the growing point. And obviously, y'all have seen this before. We get that cupped, gnarled-up leaves, the thrips generally feed on the underside of the leaf, and when they have rasping, sucking mouth parts, and when they rasp on there, the fluids leak out, and that's what they're feeding on. And a lot of times you'll see that silver marking on the underside of the leaf where they fed. But they cause this kind of damage that really prevents that leaf from being the good generator of energy like it should be, to allow that plant to grow off more normally. So that's what we want to try to prevent. Just to throw out some insecticides at plant that you should consider. Of course, here's an untreated check. The red portion of the bar is the adults, and the blue portion on some of these are the immatures. The thing about seeing immature thrips, these are the very small ones. Generally, if you look at them under a hand lens or microscope, they don't have wings. When you see immatures, you know that reproduction is occurring in the field. Okay, it's not just adults moving in and out of a field, but reproduction has occurred. So we can see that the untreated and acephate, what kind of numbers we're looking at. This is not 19 days after planting. We're still in the cotyledon stage, not even at the first leaf stage yet. So you can see what kind of control. Now, this is on 10 plants, all right? So if we're up here around 20, that's two thrips per plant, okay? That's actually above threshold. Normally, the threshold is one thrips per true leaf. So if you've got one true leaf, on average, across the cotton field, it only takes one thrips to justify an application if you're seeing immature thrips. The immatures combined in that number, then you'll probably want to go out with a foliar, because these at plant, these seed treatment products may not be working. Now, let's move out a little further from this cotyledon stage and go to the one true leaf. The same products, we've got Gaucho, Aries, Cruiser, Evicta, Evicta Duo, Gaucho 600 with Poncho Votiva, or Votivo, and then acephate. The red line there that you see is the threshold. That's right at 10. This, again, one true leaf stage, this 10 line right here would be threshold. So anything holding these numbers down below that, like the Evicta, the Aries, and the Gaucho, Pancho Votivo here, did a very good job of holding it at threshold or below. We move out then to the four true leaf stage where we can go up to four thrips per plant. So if we look at this 40 point right here, that would be the threshold. Most of these, now the Gaucho slipped a little bit, Aries still doing good, Cruiser, Evicta, Evicta Duo, Gaucho, Acephate not so much. But all those, most of these, you know, seed treatment products that are available are doing a pretty good job for us in suppressing thrips. And again, this is four true leaf, about 33 days after planting. We're keeping those thrips in check. Those are generally my top two picks, the Evicta Elite and or the Gaucho Pancho Votivo. Okay. Just some damage ratings. Again, we can see the bars that are the lowest on the chart here are pretty acceptable. We get some of these that go up a little bit in terms of damage, but not only do we want to keep the thrips in check, but we obviously want to keep damage to a minimum as well so that plant can keep moving, growing, and get into that squaring stage as quick as possible. Again, just some, you know, where we've done a really good job of keeping those leaves protected. They're unfurling completely, doing the job that they need to do versus where we're not doing such a good job and we've got thrips damage. We want to prevent that. And again, if your seed treatment's not doing the job or you took the chance and not put a seed treatment on it, there are some good foliar products out there. Obviously, Bidern's been around a long time. It does a pretty good job. Orthene still in there as well. Radiant, we've got three rates there. Looks like the really that 6.1 rate ounces is a pretty good shot on Radiant. So we still have some good foliar products that are affordable if you have to follow up from a seed treatment or just going foliar alone. Typically on the West Plains where we don't have much wheat, y'all got a little more wheat influence where you see a lot more thrips pressure up here, so really it behooves you to really put a seed treatment out. But most years we can get away with just doing foliar southwest of here. Again, just some ugly pictures of what they can do and what we should be doing to protect those plants. All right. Caitlin and Mark challenged me to kind of get, y'all are just kind of sitting there. I know y'all are probably listening, maybe learning, but it's early in the morning, and they wanted to do something a little more interactive. So you will notice, for most of you, I know some of y'all are up in the stands, but at your table, there was a sticker placed in front of you. We're going to use that here in a moment. Not all of them, but we're going to use a few of them here in a second. So when we're scouting for thrips, it's really pretty easy. And again, I know some of y'all may do this. Some of y'all hire a consultant. I would encourage you, when Dagan gets her feet on the ground this summer, get with her, and she'd probably be willing to even teach some of y'all's, you know, whether it's farmhand or kids, young farmers, whoever, how to scout. And really, thrips is the first and foremost pest that you need to learn. And it's pretty easy, really. We just look at 25 plants per quadrant, a total of 100 plants. We'll just pull that plant out of the ground, kind of cup underneath the leaves so that because those thrips will either fly off or run down the plant and you'll never see them. And most of us will probably have to put our spectacles on to see them, but because they are pretty small. And I know y'all, everybody knows, are familiar with thrips. Those are the things, particularly if you have a very light-colored shirt on, particularly a white T-shirt or something, and you're out in the field or at a ball game even in the evenings, and you feel those things biting on your arm, scratching on you, getting your face, and you can barely see them, those are thrips, okay? And that's those rasping mouth parts that are kind of feel like they're pinching, biting on you, okay? So we count all the thrips that are on those 100 plants, and we average them. And again, the threshold, one thrips for every true leaf. If we got one true leaf on average, it's one. Now, if you got a field that's, you know, 1.5, 2.5, somewhere, in there. Apply that to your thrips as well, okay? Because as you go through those 100 plants, not only are you looking for the thrips themselves, but you're also making note of what is the leaf stage, okay? And we don't count a leaf being a complete leaf until it's on these small plants. It needs to be larger than a quarter, okay? When it's unfurled and quarter size or larger, we'll consider that a true leaf. Okay. So raise your hand if you've got a Western flower thrip marked at your place. Okay. So it'd be kind of hard to count, but we were supposed to set out. I think I only saw about four or five hands, so there's probably some missing spots out there. But we figured there's about 200 seats out here, so we'll say that, of those 200 seats, it would have taken at one true leaf, it would have taken 20 thrips, right, to reach threshold, which would be 10 in 100. Actually, it would for 100 plants at one true leaf, it would have taken 100. So we're, with just those few hands that we saw raised here just a second ago, we're well below threshold. And that's probably because in this particular field, y'all were smart enough to use a seed treatment, and we've done a good job of treating. So in that situation, we wouldn't work. We'd keep an eye on it about every 5 to 7 days, keep going back out there and scouting and seeing what the thrips are doing until we get to that four-leaf stage, and then we can kind of set those thrips aside and worry about something else. And that's the other thing, too, and this applies to a lot of other, stand counts and weeds and everything. It's sometimes hard when you're still in the planting mode, trying to get things established and worrying about thrips on young, cotton where you've, that you first planted, maybe, let's say. But, guys, you've got to take somebody in your operation, again, whether it's a consultant or somebody that is on your crew, somebody, whoever it might be, a family member, somebody's got to get around to these early fields and worry about weeds and thrips and stand counts while you're still thinking about planting. Somebody better be worrying about that stuff, okay? So it's real critical. Otherwise, you're going to be worrying about this stuff that got banged up by thrips, and you're going to have to end up replanting it. And next thing you know, it's, I don't know what y'all's cutoff is, June 5th, something like that. But, you can run after that real quick by having a cotton plant out there that's been devastated by thrips if you're not paying attention. So, okay. Now I want to throw this one in there. It's not something that we deal with as much as maybe y'all do. We're seeing more and more influence from wireworms. I think y'all are, seen these wireworms are kind of a long, narrow, slender looking worm, kind of a dirty white, kind of cream colored worm. And really the seed treatments that we've already mentioned for thrips really do a pretty good job on wireworms. Wireworms generally get started in a grass crop. So if you have had a history of grain sorghum or something or corn possibly, they've moved in there. The adult is known as a click beetle. There's a couple of different species, but we just kind of lump them all into these, in this wireworm species. They all look similar. And of course, they feed on roots. And we've seen some stands, devastated, but you have to prevent wireworms. Raise your hand if you got wireworm at your table. Yeah, and that's the way, they're just kind of at random across the field. Rarely is it along one edge or, particular rhyme or reason to where they get started. It's just wherever that click beetle lands in the field and lays their eggs, and next thing you know, you've got wireworms established in a place. So, if you see stand problems, don't just look at the upper portion of the plant. Dig in that soil, see what kind of problems may be occurring even on that root system. And if you see some unusual worms, not earthworms or anything like that, but these long cylindrical larvae, and you can, if you look at them, they got a brown head on them, and they're They've got like pinchers. That's what they're using to clip on those roots. So if you see that, it may be too late this year. There's not many products out there that are very effective to control wireworms after the fact. So it's really something you're just going to have to work through to try to get a stand this year and then plan next year on putting out a seed treatment on that thing. So you're kind of at the mercy for 1 year if you hadn't noticed them prior. Now, if you know a field has a history, I definitely would not plant that field naked without some kind of seed treatment to protect it. All right, now let's move past the seedling stage and get into when we start squaring to first bloom. And these are the things. This is right here what you're going to have to really understand or keep your eye on when we start squaring is, you know, looking for these missing squares and seeing the scars on those terminals or a blasted square. A blasted square would be that little square that's excuse me, that's basically it's dead, but it's still clinging on to the plant. And or you see a flared square. The square itself may not be dead yet. It may have been hit by a stink bug or flea hopper, and that initial damage often results in those bracts that are around that square, those three bracts that flare out, kind of open up before the damage is actually seen on the square itself. But eventually, when you get that flared square, those bracts flaring out like that, that square will eventually either die, be blasted, clinging on, or it'll fall off. Now, it's not always insects that causes this kind of damage, right? It could be some kind of environmental, a hot wind or sand damage, all sorts of things, changes in weather, changes even in, rainfall or irrigation, extreme changes. So that, when that plant starts squaring, it's a balancing act between reproductive growth, which is the development of squares and ultimately bowls, but also it's still in that vegetative growth, okay? And so when you have drastic changes in the environment, again, either moisture or something along those growth regulators used to be this way. Back in the old days of picks, before it was safened with, products like boron, we often would see where we may have gotten too heavy a rate of mepaquat chloride or something would cause fruit damage. We rarely see that now, but if you go back to an older product, be careful of not getting too high because you can see this kind of situation even with growth regulators. But anytime we see this, we've got to be able to explain it. And one of the first things that I'm going to be concerned of would be flea hoppers, okay? So if we see, loss of fruit, we see damaged fruit, okay? The weather's been not so bad. We didn't mess up on a growth regulator application. Man, if I see this pest right here and I see that kind of damage, I'm going to say that's my culprit, okay? So what do we do with it? Well, really, they're pretty easy. Pretty easy to control, and it's pretty affordable too. There are several products here. This first line is now. These are the number of nymphs. These are the young flea hoppers that aren't just moving in and out. They were actually born in a field. This is the untreated check, and they're up here, around 20. The blue bar is 3 days after treatment. The red bar is a little over a week, right at, 8 days. So this would be 20 flea hopper nymphs per 3 foot of row. What we would have done on that would have been laid down a drop cloth. I like to do a whole plant inspection, but when we do these kind of tests, a lot of times we'll shake the plants out on a drop cloth and count then the number of flea hoppers in 3 foot of row. But we've used in this test Orthene, which did a pretty good job initially, Diamond, Carbine, Intruder, Bidron again. Well, I guess that's, Bidron at 8 ounces, and then Centric. In fact, Bidron, the first week, kept them pretty well in check. I think, let's see what, yeah. So anyway, those are those are pretty good products. We've got a pretty good arsenal there and pretty affordable. Thing we got to worry about sometimes is, you know, how harsh are these chemicals on some of the beneficials, because we're getting into that point when we're starting to square or even a little past that. Typically, we only worry about flea hoppers the first 3 weeks of squaring. But if we push it too late and we start using some of these harsher chemicals that can take out beneficials, then we can flare up maybe some aphids or something like that. So we've got to be thinking early. Yeah, we can use Bidrin, Orthene, but as we move a little bit later, we may want to use something a little bit softer that wouldn't cause some aphid issues. All right, so let's scout some flea hoppers. Again, we typically will look at 100 squaring plants so we can calculate not only the flea hoppers, but also, again, keep an eye on square retention. We want to know what our percentage of retention of fruit is on all those plants. And we're only looking at first position. We're not looking at, second or thirds early. We're just looking at those positions closest to the main stem. And then when we get to 25 to 30 flea hoppers, now this is the first week when we first start squaring, when we get 25 to 30 flea hoppers combined with less than 90% square set, let's say we got 10 plants in one area and we're missing one out of those 10 squares. We want to be 90% or better on our square set. When we drop below that and we're seeing flea hoppers again, we'll need to treat. Okay. Now, as we move into the second week, again, we want to make sure we got flea hoppers, the numbers there. But as long as we're above 85% square set, we're not going to mess with them. But when we drop below 85 on that second week, that's when we pull the trigger. That's when the loss exceeds the cost of treatment. Okay, that's the threshold. Then when we move to the third week, again, finding flea hoppers, if they're not there, we're not going to treat for them. Just because you have dropping squares, you better have flea hoppers. Don't just automatically think, well, something's causing, I better spray. Now, there could be something else. But when you're seeing flea hoppers, yeah, I'd say that's the blame. And when you get set less than 75% on that third week, it's time to treat. Do y'all know what when everything's said and done at the end of the season, what is our typical fruit retention? Anybody want to throw out a number? It's about 62%. Okay? So if we can achieve 75 at first position, we've done pretty darn good. Okay? Because we're not going to retain all that fruit anyway. In fact, if you look back to a year like last year where we did see a fair amount of loss of early fruit, we were able to compensate for that. The cotton plant does a tremendous job of compensating for loss of fruit. But we also know that those early pieces of fruit next, in the heart of the plant, first position down there in the bottom, that's our money bowls. Those are the biggest bowls. Those are the most valuable. And so we got to do everything we can to protect them up to this point of 75% square set where we've got flea hoppers. Okay. I'm sure most of y'all are aware of this, but most all of our pests have some kind of relationship with other plants besides cotton, okay? Mentioned the thrips. Ideally they would be found in a grass crop, and that's particularly where they overwinter. On flea hoppers, one of their weeds that we deal with that, post-roundup, and we're seeing more pressure from silverleaf nightshade. Raise your hand if you got silverleaf nightshade at your table. Okay. I would venture to guess your neighbors around you, raise your hand if you've got flea hoppers at your table. You're probably pretty close to somebody that's got silverleaf nightshade. Silverleaf nightshade is probably a preferred host over cotton for the flea hoppers themselves. They like feeding on those flowers. They like feeding on that plant. It provides them probably their best nutritional value over cotton. But let's say if you've got, you know, some silverleaf nightshade that you let escape after plant, and now that you're squaring, you see those silverleaf nightshade. Is that the good time to go after those silverleaf nightshade? Probably not, because what's going to happen when you plow out or spray those silverleaf nightshade during the first 3 weeks of squaring? You're going to force those flea hoppers onto that cotton plant. So, ideally, if you know you've got some problems with silverleaf nightshade early, take care of it before the plant starts squaring. Or then wait at least 3 weeks. And, you know, you've kind of missed some opportunity there that if the silverleaf nightshade are bad. And again, because, you know, we used to deal with silverleaf nightshade a lot easier with the Roundup back in that day. It's not as easy to deal with today just because we're not using Roundup as much. So let's see. Mentioning weeds, as I was just talking about. Let's say we sprayed dicamba or even 2,4-D, whichever technology you may be using. I'm just curious. If you're using the Xtend technology, raise your hand. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but okay, quite a few. That's, you know, in Hockley County, I'd say it's 99% Xtend. I mean, we've got some conventional, but not so much Enlist. If you're using Enlist, raise your hand. You may not want to. I don't know. Anybody got Enlist users in there? A few. It's good. It's all good technology. I think we probably went initially to Xtend. You know, some may regret it only because it requires a little more attention to detail in terms of record keeping, whereas Enlist is maybe a little bit easier. But I think some concerns about, you know, damage to neighbors, probably rightly so, and Dr. Dautre probably addressed that a little more this afternoon, but I think that's probably why we adopted Xtend a little quicker. But let's say, for example, though, regardless of which one of these technologies you're using, and I don't want to get into Dr. Dautre's subject too much from what he'll talk about this afternoon, but let's say we sprayed pretty early 2,4-D or dicamba, and you know, initially it looked like we got a great kill. We got out there in a timely fashion. Weeds were not much bigger than 4 inches. There may have been a few 6 or 8 inches, but we did a pretty good job on timing, let's say. But however, when we move out, you know, about 3 weeks, we go out there and see, you know, kind of visit the field and see how things are looking. We look around we see a few weeds that, you know, individual weeds. There'd be a dead weed right next to one, but there's that 2 and 3 foot tall pigweed that over the last 3 weeks has really gotten carried away. Raise your hand if you've got Palmer amaranth, y'all, that's pigweed, or kochia or Russian thistle at your table. Okay. They're kind of clustered up, these weeds. And when you see them growing like that, what's the concern? I don't know how many company guys are here, but a lot of times the excuse is you screwed up your application. You did something wrong. Well, there may be some truth in that. I know that happens. But guys, if you see a dead weed and then right next to it is a 2 or 3 foot weed, I'm thinking resistance. Okay? Now, there's a lot of reasons why. Now, we've got documented resistance on some of those weeds that I mentioned already to those herbicides. I mean, we've been using those herbicides for years, you know, and we're using it more. And you know, we're bound to see some resistance. If you see that, you need to call your county agent or your IPM agent or Dr. Dautre and say, get out here, let's collect some weed seed, let's do something and see if we got real resistance going on. Okay? You know, that's my biggest fear is we lose these technologies too quick. And if there is resistance out there, we need to document it and try to do everything we can to keep this technology for at least another 5, I don't know if it'll last 10 years, but if it only lasts us another couple years, I'm not sure what our next silver bullet is. It's not, it's not out there right now. So we need to keep these technologies going. So do pay attention when you go to an oxen training, if you haven't been through that. Is that, are y'all doing that today? No. Okay, but you've got one scheduled. Okay. So, but guys, pay attention when you're spraying either dicamba or 2,4-D on cotton. Do everything the best you can, because we cannot stand to lose this technology anytime soon. So anyway, if you're a cluster of weeds out there, we're coming after you with a hoe and get rid of you real quick. But before that, please report it to somebody that we can maybe, you know, just make darn sure that maybe it's not resistance. Maybe it was an overlap or something like that. Okay, let's move into mid and or late season. How are we doing on time? Okay. So mid to late season pest, primarily the cotton aphids and bollworms. And I know for years, of course, we've been fortunate not to have really bad widespread aphid problems. Every year we have pockets of those things. And for, you know, however many years now, we've had BT cottons out there where we've, in most cases, we fired our crop consultant because we don't have bollworms anymore. We don't worry about too many pests. But trust me, you better get those guys reemployed, because we do have issues. Last year, fortunately, it wasn't that bad. But the past couple of years, I have had to treat not only conventional cotton with no technology, but I've had to treat some BT cottons, Bogar 2 even. Not bad, but it was there. It was a problem. So you younger farmers are going to have to catch your eye. I mean, most of us cut our teeth on bollworms years ago, scouting, finding eggs. That was all, you know, kind of fun, and then we kind of forgot that stuff. So if you've not revisited bollworms, there's no time like the present to learn. And just on these pictures, of course, there's a bollworm egg. Looks like it looks like a beach ball, clear beach ball. That thing's no bigger than about a typed period. It's pretty small, but with a hand lens, you can see it. And right next to it, now this worm is probably 2 days old, but just imagine that little worm was inside that really small egg. That's when you got to find them. Okay, we don't generally spray on eggs, although you can. There are some ovicides out there. But typically, we got to catch those worms when they're small. Now, we don't often spray when they're that small. We're generally going to let them get a day or two older to make sure they survive. But we don't want to see these snakes. When they're that big, when they're bigger than a half inch, you can kill them, but that's revenge. That's not control. They've already done the damage, okay? It's fun to kill them, but you just wasted a bunch of money, okay? Now, fortunately, pyrethroids are pretty cheap now, but that comes with other associated cost of flaring other pests. And of course, they can damage the flowers. Here's the adult. Here's a, you know, big old snake. And they can look different, you know. Now, this is the same insect as a corn earworm, okay? Same insect. They do change color based on the material that they're feeding on. If it's a bollworm that's been feeding inside on that developing lint and seed, it's going to be fairly, you know, kind of lime green to pale, kind of a pale color. But if it's out here feeding on some leaf material or stems or, you know, kind of moving around, it may be a little bit darker in color, okay? Any questions about, I'm going to talk more about bollworms, but any particular questions on before I move on? Okay. And again, you got to recognize the damage. Bollworms are very messy feeders, okay? If you see an entry hole that's pretty good size and it's extremely clean, that could be a square borer or something like that, okay? Don't just automatically think of bollworms. You got to know some of the other pests too, but if you see an eighth-inch diameter hole, maybe even the size of a quarter-inch, because it's a big old snake, and it could be down here at the base of the bowl where that carpal wall is a lot softer than it is up here in the top half of that bowl where it's exposed to the sun. It's a little more stressed, a little bit harder material. Oftentimes, You don't see entry holes up there in that top half. A lot of times it's down here in the bottom, so that means you got to pull those bracts back, may even have to pull that calyx back a little bit to see where that small worm or mid-size, you know, mid-grown, probably a, you know, 5 to 7 day old worm may have broke into a bowl. Rarely do you get really small worms breaking into a quarter size bowl. A lot of times they'll feed up in the terminals. Most eggs are laid in the top third of the plant, and so they'll feed up there. They'll kind of move around, spiral around, feed them, and get some size to them, and then they get down in the heart of the plant and start attacking those money bowls. So that's, you got to catch them before they move down, because once they get into a bowl, there's not much you can do about it. Okay, Bathroid, there's some products out there on the market that are very irritating and can actually cause a worm maybe to move out of a bowl, and then it'll pick up some residual pyrethroid or something and kill it then. But you know, if you get a high percentage of those worms inside the bowl, they're home free for a few days, and they're going to still cause a lot of damage. So you still want to catch those small worms when they're kind of up there in the terminal before they move down into those money bowls. All right, I mentioned the BT traits. Of course, we started out years ago with just this Cry1 AC Bogard 1 technology, which is now not so good. So as we go across the second and third generation, they're getting better, but we've still got a lot of cotton varieties right here in the center with this Bogard 2, Wide Strike, and Twin Link that worms can break into, okay? So we're not excused from not having to worry or scout this generation of BT cottons. If you've got those varieties, do not turn your back on worms, okay? I'm not saying it's guaranteed you'll have problems, but if there's worm pressure in an area, I guarantee you're going to find them here, and there could be a point where they bust threshold, and you may have to treat that with a chemical. And that's a heck of a note when you've already spent all that money for that technology. I know that. But now, the third generation, again, I wouldn't encourage you to turn your back, but you're probably a little more comfortable when you get this VIP-3A introduced into that third generation of the Wide Strike, Bogard 3, and Twin Link, then yes, it's you're probably guaranteed pretty darn good boll worm control. So well, I'll leave it at that. If you got questions, I'll help you later. Got our fancy little red lines there. I didn't. Okay. So what is unacceptable damage? Well, I'd say any damage. I mean, when you get a hole on a square like that, that square's dead. It's not going to produce a boll. Okay? That's unacceptable. If that's happening on a BT cotton, you better start counting damage, and you better start counting worms. Same thing here on a bowl. That's unacceptable injury. Now, if you see a little bit of feeding damage from small worms up in the terminal, again, kind of track it. Keep an eye on it. Don't panic. Those small worms, the eggs are still going to be laid, and those eggs still have to hatch, and those worms have to take a bite of that BT in that plant in order to kill it. Okay? But when we get to seeing this kind of damage, that's when it's unacceptable, okay? All right, so what are some of the possible contributing factors that's causing the efficacy of the BT not to be as good? Well, it could literally just be resistant, okay? These boll worms, corn earworms that move in here, some of them overwinter here, but a high percentage of them are coming up off the Gulf Coast, South Texas, even Mexico. They could be coming in, you know, from any direction, but typically they're coming in from the south and the east. They could come a little bit from the west. And they've already been exposed earlier in the season, particularly those in the coastal bend, to a lot of this BT technology. So we are seeing resistance. We are monitoring that throughout the state, and not just in Texas, but it's even worse in other states. So resistance is a real thing. But we also see situations where we just get extremely high pressure. We don't see that like we did 20, 25, 30 years ago, show them age. When I was in Dimmitt, for example, when corn was dry down in, latter part of August, we'd see you know, corn earworms moving in mass, and we'd change the name, then it's cotton bollworm. We'd see extremely high numbers of bollworms moving out of corn into cotton. And that's when we'd, you know, around August the 20th through the 25th, always like clockwork, we'd have to start dealing with bollworms in cotton. Of course, plant health. We can see situations where the health of the plant, it may be a little stressed and it's not exhibiting those BT genes properly. So that could be one of the factors, environmental conditions. And then, of course, feeding on those parts of the plant that don't exhibit higher levels of BT. So those are all factors that can be accounted for causing bollworms to slip through. I'm going to skip that. But again, pay attention when you're buying varieties. You know, are you willing to pay for the latest and greatest BT? You know, does it got Bolgard 3 in it? Well, when you have that, of course, then you're going to feel a lot better about, you know, controlling bollworms. If it's still a Bolgard 2, then, you know, you better have some prepared to have somebody watching that field on a regular basis and managing it accordingly. Okay, so again, we have got to scout BT cottons. And I would say even on a, you know, maybe not a weekly basis, but even Bolgard 3, I would keep an eye out. You're going to be looking for other pests. I wouldn't be surprised to, you know, find an occasional bollworm and just make sure they're not causing that unacceptable damage. So scout. Pay attention to that. The threshold today. Now, I'm old school. I go by numbers per acre, but they have developed, Extension has developed a newer, probably a little bit easier to teach, but it's where you just look at 100 pieces of fruit, typically, you know, thumb size or larger bowl that's, you know, past, you know, really mid-bloom, looking at that fruit, 100 pieces, and looking for damage. And when you see 6%, that's the threshold. And I've kind of looked at the numbers and again, I'm old school and like to go by numbers of worms per acre. The old, you know, 7,000 bollworms per acre, maybe later in the season up to 10,000. This 6% damage does equate to about 7,000 worms per acre. Okay, it's really close. And so it is a good threshold, and it's actually pretty easy to teach somebody to go out there at random, pull 100 bowls. You can even take it back to the office and air conditioner and look through there. But the thing is, just because you got damage, you also want to find worms. Okay? You want to be able to make sure that those worms didn't cycle out. And just because you got damage and it says, whoa, I better treat, you better make sure you got some worms out there combined with that threshold. I guess that's one of the reasons I still kind of stick to numbers per acre, because we're literally finding the worms. I am worried about damage, but I want to find the worms, and I want to find them when they're small, not when they're half inch or larger. And again, whether it's BT cotton or not, you've got to make a call on a threshold, and when you exceed threshold, you may have to spray. Now, my product of choice is here more recently has been something like Prevathon, because it's and now it's not a little cheaper, obviously, but it's safer on beneficials. And we're going late season, you know, into that mid-August, or even late July. I don't want to use a pyrethroid that'll flare up the aphids. I don't want to have to deal with aphids. That's another expense, another problem that we don't want to get into, and that's where you really got to be careful about choosing your products carefully so that you don't create another issue. So, BT versus non-BT, and man, we've got guys using a lot of conventional varieties over in our neck of the woods. I'm sure that's the case here, too. And it works for them. It's just like, you know, you don't necessarily have to use Xtend cotton. You know, if you you can put all the tools together using a yellow herbicide and the white herbicide, so on so forth, and do a good job of controlling weeds. Same way with bollworms and using conventional cotton. If you're scouting it, you may or may not have to spray. And just think of the economics on it. So, you know, in the past, we've always felt like there's been an advantage of using BT because it gives you that, you know, that little assurity that, you know, we're protecting yield to the maximum without having to worry about worms. But because we have some resistance issues, we're going to have to kind of maybe second guess that, and let's don't throw conventional completely out the guess or the use. Okay. Again, I've already talked about being old school, but, you know, we want to check throughout the whole field. When I check for worms, I'm looking at only 36 total plants. But in each quadrant, I'll take three consecutive plants in three spots. So I'm looking at nine plants in a quadrant. So in four different areas, 36 total plants, and I'm looking at it from top to bottom. I'm making notes of eggs, small worms, medium worms. Small worms would be, you know, those less than 3/8 of an inch. Medium-sized worms are going to be, you know, 3/8 to, you know, less than 5/8. And then anything bigger than that's going to be a large worm. I want to divide them up into those categories because I know if they're all sitting, if I got 7,000 to 10,000 large worms, I've done missed it. And I'm not, yeah, I can kill them, but there's really no need to spray for that. You've done missed it. You should have caught that a week ago or better, okay? Somebody messed up. You need to catch them when they're small. Don't, if they're all 7,000 to 10,000, you know, 1/8 to 1/4 inch worms, I'm probably not going to spray them either. I'm going to keep an eye on them, maybe go out there another 3 to 4 days and see if they've all survived, because those really small worms, one thing, they can be cannibalistic. They can eat each other. You got to take into consideration your beneficial load. If you've got lots of, you know, ladybugs and lace wings and parasites out there, man, they can hold down 7,000 to 10,000 worms pretty easily, okay? But you got to know they're there. You got to know the beneficials, and you got to keep track of them too. But if I start moving a good number of them into that medium category, you know, those half inch, around that half inch in length, man, I'm seeing damage, I'm not going to hesitate to pull the trigger, okay? Now, again, we talked about new school doing the 6%, pretty easy, 100 pieces of fruit. When you hit 6% damage with worms present, I'm going to treat. All right, raise your hand if you got cotton boll worms. Well, I'd venture to guess that, you know, we probably got pretty low numbers right there, you know, out of 200 seats you know, just about 3 or 4, I'd say, hits or place where we got worms, I'd say we're probably well below thresholds. If I did have to treat, again, I'm probably going to use Prevathon, you know, 16 to up to 20, 24 ounce. If I got some really big drip cotton I'm trying to get coverage on with a plane, I may push that to 20, 21 ounces of Prevathon. If I've got a smaller statured plant going with a ground rig, I could probably get it down to, you know, 14, 16 ounces. So, and again, keep make note of beneficials, and weather can play a factor there as well. Okay, cotton aphids. When you see the honeydew, that's not good. But the thing about aphids are, you know, they can flare up in a couple spots. Let's just go ahead and see who's got cotton aphids at their table. Okay, they're just kind of clustered up, and they can explode in some areas. And, you know, when they build up to too high numbers, that's when they start spreading across the field. But, you know, here the past few years, a lot of times these clusters where we get, you know, maybe a half dozen plants with a lot of honeydew, some pressure, after about 2 weeks, they start to crash. And you got to kind of watch that. You don't always want to be trigger happy with aphids. But at the same time, you don't want to let them go too far. I mean, it's kind of a guessing game, but you got to watch the numbers, and that's why thresholds are so important. So I'm going to throw out a few chemicals here. This is a trial Dr. Suhas conducted there at the Lubbock Experiment Station. This is 3 days after treatment. This is numbers per leaf. This untreated, no chemical used, is about 17, 18. Aphids per leaf, not too terribly bad. That's not what I would consider, you know, threshold yet. Usually threshold is going to be 35 to 50 per leaf, but you know, he was trying to jump in there early because some of these products you want to kind of get on the leading edge before those aphids. It'll clean up some, you know, in, Intruder, Savanto, some of these will do a really good job of cleaning up some big numbers, but sometimes we want to get in there, especially if it's got, you know, something like a imidacloprid in it, get in there a little quicker. So anyway, we got Carbene, Intruder, Centric, Savanto. The Centric there looks like it let it slip up a little bit higher. Let's go up to a test in Plainview. Again, we use Carbene, Intruder, a couple of rates of Intruder, Transform on this one, Admire Pro and Centric. They all kept, this is, that red line is the threshold. The Admire Pro was just right at. That, again, about 35 aphids per leaf versus the untreated, which really jumped up to 150 per leaf. So was fixing to be a pretty bad problem. But this is only 3 days after treatment. It did a pretty good job. And, of course, that there again, that Admire Pro is an imidacloprid product. It doesn't always it does a good job of suppressing population, but it doesn't always take it completely out. All right, and this is the impact on the upper portion of the plant, about the same. Of course, Meyer Pro did a little bit better job because it got better exposure or better coverage up in the upper portion of the plant. Okay, I'm going to move through. This is just some numbers on the lower portion. Again, we see where the imidacloprid in the bottom of the plant, because of coverage, didn't do quite as well. All right, so let's again, we saw the hands out there. Let's how do we scout? Are we doing good on time? I'm about done. Okay, I'll start to wrap it up. Thank you. Yeah, we could do cotton scouting 101 for a whole semester. I know we got some college kids here. We could talk about this in a. There should be a whole semester's worth of information. But so scouting, we're going to look at just 10 plants in each quadrant, a total of 40 plants. We're going to divide that plant up into the top portion, the middle portion, the bottom. We're going to pull a leaf from each one of those, and we're going to average the number of aphids per leaf. And when we're really above 35 to, you know, 50 aphids per leaf on average, that's our threshold. Now, as we get in later part of the season, we start seeing crack bowls. That threshold is going to drop down to 10 aphids per leaf. Okay, we're going to be a little more aggressive because we don't want to get into that situation where we have sticky cotton. Okay, ligus and stink bugs. I'll roll through this one pretty quick. We didn't see as many ligus this year as we did stink bugs, but ligus are always, particularly ligus hesperus, are, you know, always a concern because they're so much more aggressive. They're much bigger. They're very similar to a flea hopper, but they're about, you know, 2 to 3 times bigger, and they can really do a lot of damage. We're going to look at 6 foot a row in about 10 locations, and the first 3 weeks of squaring, when we see just 2 ligus on that on those plants with dropping square set, we're going to spray. And then as we go a little further into bloom, we'll double that to 4 ligus plus, you know, combined with fruit loss. Some of the products we could use, Vidate. Of course, Vidate is pretty harsh. We can use that early, particularly if you're in an area that may have some nematodes, that you get some benefit there spraying pearly, you know, early. But it, Vite in itself can create a bad aphid problem if you're not careful. Acephate does a pretty good job, Diamond Steward, Carbene, Dimethylate Biter, and some of these other products. Stink bugs, whether it's the green or Conchuela, we saw both this last year. We're going to look at it, and this is a pretty intense scouting. This is probably the more difficult insect to scout for. We're going to look at 100 pieces of fruit. We're going to literally probably take them back to the tailgate on the pickup or the office, and we're going to have to dissect that those bowls to see if, you know, the stink bug caused, you know, when they sting that fruit, did that stinger go all the way through that carpal wall? Did it just create a wart on the inside of that wall, or did it penetrate all the way in to the lint where it'll cause staining or death of the development of that lint? So stink bugs are pretty tough to scout, but when we see greater than 20% damage and we're also seeing stink bugs, then we're going to use something, again, very similar to these other products, Acephate, Bifenthrin, Bidrin, Bathroid, You can see the list there. All right. I know that I've got several other pests. I'm gonna call it quits right now on that. I will mention I had a couple of scenarios on corn and grain sorghum, and I just want to throw those out real quick because I know we're, I think most of us are thinking, you know, growing cotton, worst case scenario, may have to, you know, plant back to grain sorghum or corn. But, you know, sugarcane aphids, I don't think should be an excuse to be fearful of growing grain sorghum. I think we know enough about the sugarcane aphid that we can effectively control the sugarcane aphid. Raise your hand if you've got sugarcane aphid at your table. Okay, there should be kind of over here on this side, because that's the direction probably if you're looking at a field of grain sorghum in our relation or our proximity to the cap rock, those things are probably going to blow in and be kind of on that east and south corner, okay? Versus something like corn, we're talking about spider mites. Raise your hand if you got spider mites. They're going to be kind of in the southwest because, again, that's prevailing wind. Not, you know, it could be because you've got an old homestead or some trees. If you've got an old homestead sitting in the southwest corner of a cornfield and or some old elm trees, I guarantee you, you're probably going to want to spray some comite in that southwest corner. But anyway, you got to kind of know some of these pests and how they move and what direction they move from. A lot of times they're just clumped in distribution, but don't hesitate to get to know your new IPM agent. We welcome her, and good luck to her, and we'll help her out as much as we can to get her started. Y'all have got a great history here. Some of y'all probably remember Mark Brown when he was your IPM agent in Crosby, Florida. That was quite a few years ago, but there's been some good ones here, so keep that tradition going. Thank you for your time, and I'll turn it back over to your host.